Hello, 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 and welcome to this week's extra special episode of the Imagine Only Podcast, a podcast where we put on our plastic radioactive condom suits, jump into the, for some reason, plastic-covered future gurney and get inseminated back to 1990. My name's David.
Hello, David. My name's Sam. And yes, I feel... condom suit, insemination. This feels like a good start to a family-friendly podcast about a time travel movie from the 90s. I think we're in a good place. That feels like a good start to me. Feels like a fresh start. Ready. Primed. Let's do it.
Is it the same year? Is it literally the same year?
As the film we did last week.
As Time Cop. I think it's the following year.
It's a year later. Yeah, so we're in... Welcome to the imaginary time travel podcast, where we're going to talk about time travel forever.
This time travel is especially imaginary.
Well, I think this is an interesting one. So if you haven't listened to our previous episode, shame on you. No, it's fine. Time Cop, go back and listen to that, because it's just total trash. Trashy Van Damme movie. Fun, but whatever. Whereas this movie, ladies and gentlemen, 12 Monkeys, Terry Gilliam, actual, like, this is what time travel should be. This is how time travel should work. And this is a great, great movie, isn't it, Dave?
It was very fun. I enjoyed it very much. I hadn't seen it before. Now, as people who listen to podcasts regularly will know, we've watched a lot of movies. We are fucking nerds. However,
nearly 300 movies, yeah.
Everyone has their blind spots, and I always conflated this with 12 Angry Men, which I also haven't seen. Please don't shout at me.
Hold on. I mean, wrong, like completely wrong end of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. Completely different. One of them's about a jury in the 1950s, and the other one's about time travel in the 90s. Just because it has 12 in the title.
Exactly. Exactly.
What about 12 Ronin? Are you confusing that as well?
Probably, but specifically, so when you said we should watch 12 Monkeys,
it's 47 Ronin, isn't it? It's not 12 Ronin. What's the 12 Ronin? There's the 12 Ronin. It's a slightly reduced version.
It's a lot less exciting version, yeah.
Yeah.
Is that
it's a prequel.
Tom Cruise movie, or is that The Last Samurai? We're tangentially moving off the point here. My point is that I don't think it's unreasonable for me to confuse two movies I hadn't seen and didn't know what they were about. So when you said 12 Monkeys, I was like, isn't that a courtroom movie? Isn't that like a... Because, you know, obviously... Do you know what it is, though? I think 12 Monkeys is... Even now, like, it's a time travel movie, and yeah, absolutely, but it's still quite hard to like quantify, because it's not a time travel movie like Back to the Future is a time travel movie, and it's not a time travel movie even like Terminator is a time travel movie. It's not even a time travel movie like Time Cop's a time travel movie.
Yeah. Ultimately,
and we're going to talk about this again, but like ultimately a time travel movie usually is using the time travel to achieve something, and... That's the exact opposite of what this movie is doing.
It's a real, almost kick in the teeth, isn't it, this movie? Like, the ending...
Perfect.
It's perfect, right? So straight off, we are obviously going to spoil this. So if you've not seen it, then what are you doing? But go watch this movie, right? And I think I fucking love a movie that doesn't try and trick you, doesn't try and spin it at the end. It just culminates perfectly. And I think this is a film that from the very first shot of the movie right until the end, it's so coherent. The timeline that they create is so fucking perfect. And I think I don't know if there is a better time travel movie, and I don't mean necessarily the story and plot and stuff, but in terms of representing what time travel is probably going to be like if and when we do it, like we're not going around the sun in warp 9, you know, we're not doing anything silly. It's exploring the idea of predestination and whether or not you can actually change. Can you change the past? Because yeah, by changing also... it, by being there, by attempting to change it, you've already changed it, which means it's like, and so I think we should definitely get into that. And there's lots of mind.
I want to talk through the plot of this a little bit, and maybe we can save our time travel splurge.
Fast forward, listeners. That's what a teaser is on a podcast. It's just an opportunity for you.
What
to
I
want to
talk
forward.
About. I just want to compare Terry Gilliam, who's I've not seen, as we just discussed before the podcast. I haven't seen any of his movies before. This is, I guess, kind of because so many of them were made in like the 90s and before. So I've seen the any of his movies that aren't Monty Python movies, I should say, mm-hmm. because I am British and over 20, and therefore I've seen all the Monty Python movies. So I hadn't seen any of his other movies, I think, because like it's a lot harder to market any of them at kids, you know, in a lot of ways.
Yeah,
it's not really like a Sunday night ITV movie.
Well, if you've not seen many of these, so I think I've seen quite a lot of them. I think my parents were quite into these movies because we watched Monty Python, Holy Grail, Jabberwocky, you know, like kind of 70s. But we start to really wake up with Time Bandits, Brazil, Baron Munchausen, which is fucking such a bizarre, crazy film. It's absolutely bizarre, but you love it. Fisher King is great as well, 12 Monkeys. And that's where it stops for me in 1995. I haven't seen anything after that. But there's such a like distinctive style that he brings to movies. And there's like the weird, you know, the weirdness of Monty Python and
it's
why people in the 70s.
I hesitate to use the word. It's auteur-y. I mean, I was watching this movie and I was trying to think of directors like Jim Cameron, great director, but he makes a very like, he makes a Hollywood movie. You know, Spielberg's the same, Lucas, Ridley Scott even. Like, they make a prototypical Hollywood movie. The directors I was trying to think of who make movies like this, Wes Anderson makes movies like this, where he is telling a story at you, and that's, you know, sometimes good and sometimes bad, but there's a large amount of, like, intentionality behind it, and very much, like, one person beaming into your brain via the television, like, their vision for what this script was. David Lynch is the same as well. Like, it kind of Mulholland Drive, I can't imagine you've seen it because it's 14 hours long and makes no sense and goes nowhere in the most perfect, bizarre, baffling, confusing way possible. But like, it's the same sort of thing where it's kind of like this is my vision, this is the film that you are watching, and I care not for your feelings of wanting a happy ending or anything like that, in the best way possible. And I think it leads to a much more sort of like artistic film, maybe, than, like I mentioned, you know, Jim Cameron and Spielberg and Ridley Scott and, you know, even Scorsese. Like, they make a great movie, but they make a very prototypical ABC plot, you know, three-act structure. And I think this is kind of like the opposite end of the movie spectrum to that.
Mm-hmm.
In a good way.
And I think we're exploring different things. Like, I think Terry Gilliam is able to maybe go places that some of those more mainstream directors you're talking about just don't want to or can't, or it doesn't fit within the sensibilities of them telling. And I'm holding a glass of scotch, swirling it, telling intelligent stories, Dave. No, we're not doing that with Terry Gilliam movies. We're being weird. We're being funny. We're being dark. I mean, just go and read the plot to Time Bandits, because I think you are gonna, just like I knew last week, you'd love this film. I think you're gonna fucking love that movie. And we see all through, I think, his filmography, Brazil, sci-fi dystopia. Like, we see like the ideas of not maybe quite anti-capitalist, but anti-authority, and like the authoritative state and all this other stuff is incomplete. And I think all of this is just such a beautiful tapestry. And I think 12 Monkeys, I don't know if it's, I'd have to rewatch them all to see where it fits in terms of his, you know, the scale of his movies. But I think I really really love this film because it takes what is a cool idea, time travel, you know, which we've seen lots and lots. And we've seen it in Time Cop just a year ago. And we've seen it in Back to the Future and Terminator and all the other things we talked about last week. But I think it does something different. I think it does something quite unique in almost shitting all over the idea that there is a Polaroid of your family that is slowly fading away to represent the change of the timeline. Fuck you, no, we're not doing any of that shit. That's gone in this movie. I love that.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting take on the time travel. Let's just talk about the time travel thing now, I suppose.
Let's do it right now. I've got so much to say.
It's an interesting take on the time travel for like several reasons. I mean, the movie's never really clear. I think it's a really good choice in the movie to not be really technical about the time travel. You know, much in the same way that Terminator's like, there's a machine, it sends you back in time, you've got to be naked. Okay. Seemingly that rule also applies here, by the way.
It doesn't do what Time Cop did, which is we have got a rocket car underground that we're going to hurl at a wall at 100 miles an hour. Yeah, sure. Well, that's fine. Like, yeah. It's not even interested in going there, is it? It doesn't care.
But there's also like a question of like the recall. So Bruce Willis, the star of the movie, fantastic role for him. Is this before Fifth Element? This is like...
It is before 97's Fifth Element, yeah. So we've got
this
much
more. This is
peak
Bruce Willis for me. He's funny. So good. He looks fantastic. If Bruce Willis had hair, do you reckon God made Bruce Willis bald to limit his power?
I think so. I think it, I
if
think
he had hair, he would have been the biggest star on TV on
he
in
did.
Films
he
for
did his,
50 years.
I know. George Clooney hair and he's sorted. Sorry, do you have more to say on time? Do you want to? Because I've got.
Yeah, no. So the movie doesn't ever make it super clear what's going on about the recall and things, and they certainly, you know, they're talking to him and saying you can't exist here and in the past, and it seems to be very clear cut. That you can't affect the timeline. And he's talked about parallel universes and all sorts, but the idea that you can't influence the future you've come from. And it doesn't get really deep into it, but it's an interesting premise. He's going back in time to save the world, but he's not going back in time to avert a disaster. He's going back in time to save the present. And I think that's a recognition from the present that, you know, by altering history, altering the past, even if they could do it, you would destroy the present. It's an interesting sort of thing that you just left to think about throughout the movie. The movie's not overly concerned with.
Yeah, you're absolutely right because it's not about changing. There's no you know, save the cheerleader, save the world type mission for him. I think it comes down to his powerlessness. Bruce Willis, like he is just another grunt who can remember things, and that's his special ability. And so when he's sent back, it is only to collect information that they so they can try and figure out some way of sending people back up to the surface. They don't think or they don't want to prevent the pandemic from happening. And I think that is probably the most important thing about this the time travel in this movie is that. And here we go, spoilers. The first thing we see is Bruce Willis as a kid watching Bruce Willis get shot. And I think as you're watching the film, you kind of think, oh, well, that's what he's going to try and prevent. And he's going to, you know, you think there's going to be a certain point where that's not going to happen. And he's going to be able to get away. And that's the whole, because that's what you get from you know, time travel movies. But it's almost, I think, the whole objective of the leaders, you know, the people who we see who are questioning him in the lab coats, they want the pandemic to happen. They want all the people to die. It's quite important. And when in the last scene of the movie, they're sat down, the guy sits down with all the vials of shit and the woman, one of the same women who's on the, whatever it is, the, you know, the leadership, saying, oh, I'm in insurance. which is basically, I'm here to make sure you do your that you carry out what you're supposed to be doing, which is to spread this horrible disease all around the world. Like, so it kind of raises questions about what their drive is, and actually they need Bruce Willis to be shot at the end. Like, that's the whole point. The whole point.
Well, I think this is what I was saying. I think, and this is the great thing about movies like this, is it leaves so much up to your own interpretation
to figure out.
Because, like, as good as this is the comp, as good as Back to the Future is about explaining 12 million gigawatts or whatever it is, and 88 miles an hour, and the flux capacitor, and it's all nonsense. But, like, having a scientific-ish explanation is kind of like important to the mechanics of that movie. But this is proving that you don't really need to explain any of that. You know, like I said, much in the same way that Terminator, it's just a thing that happens on the screen. But in this, I really do think it's this, like you said, she's in insurance. She's there to ensure that this virus infects everyone. Bruce Willis is given the gun knowing that he'll be stopped at security because he's got a gun, and the police will shoot him because he's got a gun. Like, he's never supposed to. And that kind of sets in after you finish watching the movie. But the idea being that I think the people in the future recognize that the way that time works, and obviously we don't have time travel, so this is all like made up, this is all sci-fi nonsense, but the way that temporal actions affect the timeline, if we subscribe to the, like, the most basic, like, you know, time travel rules, that if Bruce Willis goes back in time and alters this world-changing event, then the future that existed to send him back to alter the world-changing event wouldn't exist, and exactly. Therefore the world-changing event would still happen anyway, and therefore it's, you know, the idea that, well, it's fruitless to try and go and change something so huge.
And, well, let's break it down. So let's say at the start of the movie, Bruce Willis as a child watches Bruce Willis as an adult shoot the guy with the vials of bacteria or whatever it is. And according to 1985 Back to the Future rules, when he went back then to the past, when he went back to Bruce Willis in prison time, none of that would exist, because the end of the world wouldn't have happened, and he would be working as an insurance salesman in, you know, Newark or whatever, like whatever he would be doing. And so when he went back, he would land in, and everyone else would have no idea what the pandemic is, and that's fine. So that's Back to the Future rules, is that you can. But what this movie is saying is that if he shoots the guy, and but he came from a world, a time in the 2030s when the pandemic is real and he was in prison and he got extracted, then the very fact that he was in that position means that he didn't achieve that the vials still managed to go off elsewhere. So it's like, it's this idea, the whole idea of the movie, and it's fucking genius, is that it's futile because Bruce Willis is watching, has already seen it happen, and if he's seen it happen, then it's going to happen, and there is nothing you can do to change it. And that's what
seems to be the outlook of the scientists from the future, is certainly that what they want is a sample of the virus so that they can create a cure in the future.
Yeah, because I think, and I think the movie leaves it on the table as to why don't they want to cure it? Why would they not try and stop? Why are they actively trying to make sure that
I took away from it.
I took away from it, certainly, that the...
Like, it's the whole idea of, like, so, right, sci-fi nonsense here. The whole idea of if I clone myself and then I kill the original me, the clone me kills the original me, I'm still dead. So if you change the past so that you've changed the future, you cease to exist. I think there's that's the ultimate goal of these people in the 2035, that if they change the pandemic, then they no longer exist. Either way, they no longer exist.
Exactly. I think they're trying to retain
about
their power.
It's far enough in the future. It's 40 years in the future. It's far enough that I think there's less of a we've got to save all these people we lost and more of a we've got to save our world as it is now.
And we want to be able to go outside, you know, basically. Like, and I just think that's just a genius idea. It's a genius idea. And I think the way that then, and I think it takes, it's not something I think you get straight away. I think it takes maybe a couple of viewings to really understand it. But basically nothing, everything that Bruce Willis does, even taking his own teeth out, and Jose comes at the airport, gives him the gun and says, why'd you take your teeth out, man? Like, that's a nightmare. Like, all of this stuff, they still, well, they didn't know it was going to happen, but it was going to happen. It's not even that the authority figures back in the future are all knowing. They don't know necessarily because they haven't done,
but it doesn't matter because they've got as many rolls of the dice as they need because they can do time travel.
They can keep doing it over and over again.
It's really clever. It's really clever. Can we talk about the future before we talk about the rest of this movie? It's really clever in all the future bits, how little we see. So we get, I love the decision to have the comp shots where you see Bruce Willis sees a few locations. And it's only a brief scene where he's above ground in the present. You see a few locations where, so the department store that we see in the future, that's kind of like that wonderful, like the Fall of Capitalism, Planet of the Apes thing where it's like, the ceiling's starting to decay, but
clothes
like
left
still,
on
the mannequins
rails.
Have still got clothes on them. The clothes still on the rails.
I know, man.
And then he goes back to 1996, and he's in the shop, and you're having these flashes, but it's so clever. And then you have the bear on top of the building, and you have, oh, sorry, the lion on top of the building, and you have that in the future as well. Again, it's just so clever the way that it kind of compares the two. But then outside of that, we see sod all of the future apart from like labs and hospital beds.
Yeah. And I think that's probably where we get the real, like, it feels the Terry Gilliam-ness is on full force here with the production design and the costuming and just the general weirdness, the general kind of like everything that's covered in a film of water. That's what it feels like, you know. There's just water dripping everywhere, and it's just disgusting and slimy, and these prisoners are treated like animals. They're in cages, can't even stand up, you know. Like, it's just.
My favorite shot of the movie, I should say, is when he wakes up in the future for the second time, I think. And you have some of the doctors, and there's music playing, and they're singing. And then, like, more doctors stand up behind the other doctors.
On Strawberry Field.
And you've got the painting above him. And then you have this disorient scene where Bruce Willis is in the bed. It's been parodied everywhere. And he's in, like, the blanket he's got has got bears on it and things. And you need to get better. You've been pardoned. And they hold up the thing like, pardon. And the clipboard. And we're so proud of
well
you.
Done,
you're
James.
A very special good boy. And it's so surreal. Like, the whole movie made me feel like I was drunk in the best possible way. I really look forward to watching this movie again, which isn't not the case with every movie. But just because it's so intentionally discordant that I think you find yourself... You know, you're watching whatever fucking Fast and Furious movie comes out, and it's like, well, I can look at my phone for 40 minutes and I won't have missed anything. Whereas this, I felt I didn't want to look away from the TV at all because I'll have missed, like, some amazing, like, Dutch angle or, well, I won't have done so many, I mean, pick one. But, like, I'll have missed some amazing cinematography and some, like, tiny little, like, just layer on the onion
more.
That is this set design.
The Dutch angle being the sideways-y kind of more Dutch angles than a math class in Holland, and like I think that is I love the whole vibe that you get from that, because it's so wacky as well, like the wackiness that you're describing and the wildness that I think is really like, I think when you go and watch the rest of the Gilliam movies, which I think you're going to fucking love it, like, wait till you get to Baron Munchausen. Like, holy Jesus, is that movie insane. It's insane in the membrane. Honestly, it's absolutely nuts. And yet, right, and yet, I love all that. And yet, at the same time, we have, I think, laser-like precision in the way that they manage to... We get these occasional reminders of James when he's a kid. And we get different versions of that. We get a version where it's Brad Pitt who's looking back, and a version where we don't see who's looking back. We get to see, the baddie, what's his name? Oh, I can't remember. The guy who's releasing all the stuff. But then at the same time, there's versions where
David
we get
Morse,
to see Matt.
Dr. Peters.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He is a peak. Hey, it's that guy.
It's that guy, yeah.
He was
then we get ones...
on House.
Yes,
he's
that's
in the
it.
Green,
yeah.
In the Green Mile.
Loads of...
The Rock.
Oh, he's in The Rock. That's right. He's one of the guys.
He's
the
a hey, it's that guy. He is the prototypical hey, it's that guy. He's never starred in fucking anything in his life and never will. But he's a great character actor and he shows up and he's great.
We love you, dude.
David Morse.
Madeline Stowe as well, who has she's done a lot of TV. In fact, there's a show that Nicola watched where she was in and I was like, I know that face and that's why. But I think she's great and she has such an important role because as much as she's not even like the audience analog, which I think she so could be.
No, because she's fucking psychotic in the second half of this movie.
But it's because it's so clever. It's because this man has been like has run through this woman's life. The scene in World War One is one of my favorite scenes in all movies. Because I think it feels
butt naked Bruce Willis, that does it for Sam. We get a lot
in
of
the
that
mud,
in
the Somme. Like
in the Somme. The specific kink. It's very difficult
Google it.
To find.
Don't Google it, in fact. No, it's fine. But this is a scene that in the moment it feels so like, oh, they just fucked up. Because they're like, oh yeah, we're gonna get you back to 96, we're gonna get you back to 96, and then it's 1916. And there's French people with guns and shells going off, shouting at him, and he doesn't know what's going on, and he's naked. And everyone's like, what the fuck is happening? It's chaos. It's pure chaos. And then we get to see Jose's there, and that's gone wrong as well, and everything's right. But that actually ends up being a massively, massively important scene to the whole movie. Again, chaos and madness and what the hell's going with precision, because if he doesn't have the World War One bullet in his leg, Madeline Stowe's not going to recognize him from that photo in one of the books that she's written, and she's like, you're there, how are you, like, so there's all of this stuff that connects so well. I think like that is
clever and it
hard
lends
to the
turn as well. I mean, the movie hits full wacky when they go to a by-the-hour hotel.
Yeah.
And she has the real... And I think that's the point where she's like... I think... accepted that this guy's telling the truth and he's from the future. And I think that breaks her brain a little bit.
It does.
Like... And so she becomes quite manic for the rest of the movie. And she's wildly in love with Bruce Willis. And they've had, like, good chemistry throughout this movie. Mm-hmm. But, like... I think it's largely that... she's lost her mind a little. So they beat up this pimp and Bruce Willis pulls his teeth out and they run away and they get these wigs and this mad plan to go to the Keys, wherever they're flying to. And it's manic. It's like there's, you know, and then she's bringing the energy while at the same time Bruce Willis has kind of gone from being that at the beginning of the movie to... being a lot more toned down and a lot more cogent and a lot more lucid towards the end of the movie, which I think balances really well. So by the actual end, they're both kind of like they have equalized their mania for the last scene in a way that works really well. They play off each other really well. So the romance thing doesn't just feel like Stockholm Syndrome, which is, you know, what the police think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Like, I need to pace myself because otherwise we're going to go on for 5 hours about how how goddamn good this movie is. Have we talked about the editing? I don't think we have specifically, because I think that's probably the biggest contributing factor to this movie working as well as it is that the way we intersect from the past to the future, the past to the future, and then we have a random scene of Bruce Willis as a kid, and then, like, the construct of this movie, I think, could fall apart so quickly. And we've seen it before. We've seen it in Time Cop. I think, going back to the last episode, the reason the time travel doesn't work in that movie is because the distinction between what's happening in different time periods is not good enough. Van Damme looks too alike in that movie, doesn't he? There's a bit where they're like, oh, who are you? And it's like, dude, I look exactly the same. And my hair is slightly different and I'm wearing a different costume. But basically, you would recognize me from 5 years ago today. Like, it would be fine. You could do that. Whereas I think in this movie, because of the distinction in terms of like how horrible and underground the future is, how 1990s the 90s is, the use of light and the way that they just, I think, pace out the movie so that we're not spending too long in each period or too little. We get to immerse ourselves in the time periods and then we're very clearly taken somewhere else and we're given the clues, like Bruce Willis has got a bullet in his leg, to anchor us and give us a sequence.
Yeah, it's enough. And yeah. It's filmmaking we don't always see. And that's what I mentioned earlier about kind of like the auteur director. And I think the editor, by the way, is Mike Audsley, who also did an Interview with a Vampire the year before this.
Also Brad Pitt.
And, and High Fidelity, Captain Corelli's Mandolin. He's been working for, you know,
this man knows
years.
What he's doing. Yeah.
Yeah, he did one of the Harry Potter movies and all sorts. But like, with it being an auteur
director. Which one? Which one?
Huh?
Which one did he do? The fourth one.
Mm. Yeah, he's worked with Mike Newell a bit. But Gilliam being... I was reading some trivia on the old Internet Movie Database, so take this with a very large pinch of salt. But the idea that and I believe this, that Gilliam had like final say on the film. Like, yeah. Final cut is a really key, and not every director has the cachet to say... to have that. So even films like Blade Runner, which a previous episode, where we watched the theatrical cut, which is vastly inferior to the director's cut, and that's because Ridley Scott didn't have the cachet at the time to say, no, this is the movie I want to show. And so they reshot the ending with the happy ending, and it, like, if Gilliam didn't have that with this movie, this would have been studioified and we would have had like a happy ending, and, you know, mm-hmm. Bruce Willis and Brad Pitt and Stowe driving away in a car at the end of the movie, and we don't have that. And I think that's such a key part on top of the editing as to why we don't get there's no reshoots to make this like make more sense or, you know, be happier. I think because your typical movie going audience, I think, generally, if this had come out even 10 years later, I think it wouldn't have made any money at the box office, because I think your general studio going audience wouldn't have understood it or had the time for it. Whereas maybe this was that peak time where, you know, we're still pre-internet largely and people are going to go to the cinema anyway. So this made money based on word of mouth and people, you know.
And that final cut is, I think he made his Time Bandits made off a budget of $5 million, made like $42 million. So he had cachet to be able to say, listen, guys, come on. You've made plenty of money off me for my first movie. Give me a little bit of respect for
it's a bit.
For
it's
the
a big
ones.
Thing, though. It's like the Simpsons thing where they, that Fox is only allowed to give them so many notes. They're not allowed to make them change anything, basically. And again, it gives you that freedom to kind of like be a little punchier. And this movie is so dark and so full of pathos and so confusing and like wonderful, and it's hard to look at sometimes, and it's certainly hard to follow if you would, you know, weren't paying huge amounts of attention, or you weren't as much of a genius as I am, having only watched this movie once and having such a good understanding of it.
Because you can Google shit. I would like to say, as a bit of criticism, I do think the first act is just the slight slightest bit slow. And I feel like we could have... I feel like getting out of the insane asylum...
Boo!
I know, because it's great. And Brad... We haven't even talked about Brad Pitt. Brad Pitt just we're having great fun.
I said to you, when I watched about half an hour of this movie, I said, I kind of hope we don't ever leave the mental asylum.
I know.
Like,
but that's because
it's
you're
so...
an...
good. It's because I'm an insane person. Yeah, I
recognize
that.
You're an insane fucking sad nerd. That's why. But I do think we could maybe just shave off just a few minutes from that. We could maybe get to Tom Cruise.
The kidnapping lacks a lot of... I think the kidnapping has a lot of heavy lifting to do. And I think the fat is actually in that section.
Maybe. But I'll give you a specific
example.
Because
we've got to kind of like have the kidnapping, and then we've got to... have the fake out where you think he might have murdered her, and then we have to go to the party to confront Brad Pitt, and it's a lot to kind of then wrap up the kidnapping.
But what about the bit where he tries to escape, walks into the operating room where they're giving the guy the MRI or whatever, and then gets beaten up and put? I just think get rid of that bit, because that way we can just have straight. I think we're probably both right. You could shave off. I mean, you know, it's like the way it goes with these type of movies, but I do think there is a little bit of fat here we could trim.
Yeah, you could have it. He escapes from the ward, he unlocks the door, and he's going down the corridor, he gets in the lift, and then he disappears. And that's probably 10 minutes of film. Like, no, probably 7 minutes, maybe.
Or just have Brad Pitt make a scene earlier, which is great. Let's talk about, right? And then we'll maybe...
Brad Pitt wouldn't. I don't think Brad Pitt would have done this movie if it had been.
I'm not even talking about Brad Pitt. I think Brad Pitt is inconsequential to this film, and
I just want to mention it in relation to.
Yeah, no, I'm with you.
No, totally, but I'm going to interrupt you and override
you. No, I'm not. I'm making a point. Is that Brad Pitt is in this movie, right? And Brad Pitt's doing really pretty well at this point. He's kicking off his career. And the title of the movie are irrelevant. Like, how insanely brave is it to take Brad Pitt and to name your entire movie over about the 12 monkeys, and for that to be a complete red herring that is nothing to do with a pandemic, and it's irrelevant. They just wanted to release some animals for a laugh.
I will say, I don't mean to take away from your point at all, but the timing of this movie is really interesting. Because Brad Pitt broke out into being an A-list celebrity while they were shooting this movie.
Yeah.
Like, his other movies came out. Interview with a Vampire is a really big one. Like, that came out while they were making this movie. So when they hired Brad Pitt for very little money, by all accounts, because this only cost $30 million to make or something, when they hired Brad Pitt wasn't Brad Pitt. When the movie came out, suddenly Brad Pitt is Brad Pitt, and it changed... Do you know what I mean? If this movie had been made a year later, they'd have had to pay him a lot more money, and yeah. I think he would have had a lot larger, a lot bigger role in the movie. That's all I wanted to say on that.
But it kind of gives you that, like, I think the cast is so important to this movie, because I think they do a lot of the heavy lifting in terms of just selling the idea of this being a movie that normal people can watch. You know, Bruce Willis and Brad Pitt doing that. Definitely there is like the prominence later on for him, but it's one of his great roles though, isn't it, where he's able to like to really there's a craziness to him that I think is interesting, and we don't get to see much of it now anymore because he's too big.
It's your intentional famous, Brad Pitt trying to move away from sexy Brad Pitt, which he then yo-yoed way back into in about a year after this movie came out. But it's like this and Seven, it's kind of this like
Fight Club.
I'm a serious actor, so I'm going to appear in this weird Terry Gilliam movie. He is an excellent character actor in this movie. I do think you maybe could have had like the list that you could people who could have also done this is quite long, but I think Brad Pitt's doing a really good job.
He's
here
doing a good job. But just to that point though about 12 Monkeys, The whole title of the movie, this guy's entire role what a choice to make it completely irrelevant to the film and nothing to do with the main plot really. It is a total red herring that drags you. The whole movie's dragged. Where are the 12? Find the 12 monkeys. Find. Have you seen this man? Have you seen this symbol anywhere? Like, it is layered thick. And then the movie just deftly, just at the end, says, oh, well, doesn't matter. Don't worry about that.
What's the interesting thing about the time travel again is that the whole movie, and this is the genius point of the mania of Stowe's character, of like, she rings the, what are they, commercial cleaners. Bruce Willis gets given a phone number, and basically the idea is that they have the, in the future, they've got the answering machine. They've got the answering machine from this cleaning company that had gone bust or something. And so they've got like 6 months worth of, or however long it is, worth of voicemail messages on the,
well, they can go
machine.
Back probably, can't they? They can go back to whenever it was
so
still working.
The
listen
idea
to it and then...
would be that if he rings up and leaves a message on the voice on the answering machine, they've got the answering machine in the future. So what happens is...
No, they've got it in the past, Dave. They've got it in the past. They go back to the past when the answering machine works and Jose listens to it and then takes it back to the... Back
is that right?
To the, I can only imagine so. How would they have it?
No, because
it?
They have to... No, because they have to... In the future, they play Bruce Willis, the answering phone message, and they've had to restore it. Like, the audio's not very good and he can't recognise her voice. So I think, basically, they've discovered this building and they've discovered this working piece of technology from... And it's got messages from the week that the world ended.
But they don't know the context until... Yeah.
So they've listened to the they've listened to the message, and the message is from Stowe, and it says, "Find the 12 monkeys. The army of the 12 monkeys is responsible for the outbreak. Their headquarters is at, you know, one evil person street. Merry Christmas is the message, and that's what I mean about the time travel thing. It's that."
But the whole reason, though, that they're after the 12 monkeys, the whole reason that Bruce Willis goes there and plants the idea with Madeline Stowe is because he's told to do that by the leadership, who are reacting to a voicemail message they don't understand from Madeline. It's so cyclical, Dave. Holy shit.
Well, that's what you said from the very beginning. The idea that he saw himself get killed in the airport at the very beginning of the movie, it's all cyclical, Sam. And it's this wonderful... Like, this is, it's a paradox, and the whole idea is that it'll just keep going round and round and round.
Nothing.
Because the young Bruce Willis goes up and comes back and goes through it all again, presumably exactly the same. So in effect, like, you just play this movie twice and it's the same thing. This is just happening over and over and over and over again.
This is the greatest time travel movie of all time. That is my
It's really good.
Contention.
I hesitate again.
Oh, tell me something. Tell me a movie that has awakened such excitement and passionate discussion. Like, I can't. Like, yeah, fucking great. Save Sarah Connor. Blah, blah, blah. Fuck that shit, man. Like, the term... I mean, yeah, it's a cool action movie, but there is... I don't think... The only thing that comes... A similar type of thing, and it's not the same, but similar is like how...
Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home. Yes, correct. Bang! Game over.
Whales. Memento is a film that comes to mind. And not,
God,
obviously
I reckon
not,
that'd be hard to watch now.
Well, it's not a time travel movie, is it, necessarily? But what it is it's a movie about the sequencing of time and how things can, you know, basically his past self is telling his future self. So it's the only thing where I think at the end of the movie you're constructing it in your head, and that's what I love about this movie, because they have committed so firmly to this idea of predestination, and yeah, it's all cyclical. It's going to carry on going forever and ever, and it is going to do that because it appears, and this is the question, is it possible for Bruce Willis to not be killed? Like, is that actually possible? And this is where we're hitting the limits of my brain power, because you can't, if it was possible for him not to die, then that's what would happen. And like, so the idea that there isn't multiple timelines happening in this version of time travel. We have one timeline, and trying to alter it, just like you can't change the past in our sense of what time is. It's gone. But in a if aliens or whoever else or in a different dimension, we have a more fluid way of thinking about time, then that's certainly possible, which is some of the theory as far as I understand it. So like,
I think it's largely though, but that's kind of the question that doesn't have an answer.
It doesn't have
an answer. Because as far as the movie's concerned, is that the movie happened. The movie only happened because the movie happened. And that's like the answering phone message inspires the whole movie, and the whole movie is leading up to the answer phone message. It's kind of like the point of divergence. And then the scene at the end, like, you would need a third party to intervene to ever break that cycle.
And the third party are intervening, though, because they sent Jose back, who gives him the gun, who says, why'd you pull your teeth out, man? We were looking for you. Like, all of this. And then Madeline Stowe shouts, no! And he turns around and looks. And so if she doesn't do that, even, he manages to raise his and get the shot away. And so, I mean, my brain is...
It happens because it happened. It happens because the future happened and the past happened. It's, like I said, it's entirely cyclical in a really clever way. It's impossible to untangle it completely, but it's very evocative filmmaking. And certainly the start of the movie, and this is a perfect thing, the start of the movie doesn't foreshadow it, like, too much. Like, it's obviously relevant, but it's not in such a way that you're thinking about it for the whole movie.
No.
Because it's a time travel movie and we've been conditioned to think, save the cheerleader, save the world. You know?
We think we know what's going to happen. I think that's the thing with the end of this movie and the start of the movie. We kind of think, okay, I can see. And I think it subverts it in a way and gives you so much more to think about.
Totally. What did you think of the... Just before, I want to clear the rubbish here. I really love the reveal that Brad Pitt's like scheme, because it absolutely adds up that he's a mental, and it seems like really, wow, he's going to break into his dad's place and he's going to release his virus. No, they kidnap his dad. They release all the animals from the zoo and they lock him in a cage. I was like... And then they get arrested. But the scene of them sat in the back of the van with the tights is like, these guys destroyed the world?
Yeah, exactly. And I think it again goes to the movie really snubbing its nose almost at the audience, doesn't it? And so, hey, see the whole title of the movie, the whole thing, it's completely pointless.
But you're going to sit there going,
the conspiracy, because you're as insane as they are. You're as insane as they are in 2035. Because you're like, oh, it's the 12 monkeys. We got to stop the 12. No, none of it's real. God.
Going back to the idea that Bruce Willis gives Brad Pitt the idea for the 12 monkeys in the hospital. Which they mention when Bruce Willis says, you gave me the idea to wipe out humanity, which is kind of, again, a bit of a mislead, because that's not what he's trying to do.
No, it's not, but it's the thing that sets up.
The only thing that sort of not ruined it for me, but the only thing that I kept thinking of throughout the movie is they introduce Dr. Peters, David Morse, at the book signing with Madeline Stowe. And I was like, well, he's coming back.
That's an actor.
It's not even the actor. It's the orange hair. I was like, well, nobody with that haircut is not going to be a character in this movie.
Compared to the other guy who's trying to get her attention as well. Like, I suppose you need to, I know what you mean. Maybe a slightly bolder thing would have just had this guy show up.
I think if I watch it again, it will stand out more. And I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm just saying it's kind of the only thing. Because otherwise I was like, I'm just excited to see where we're going with this.
Yeah, there's lots of things to enjoy on the rewatch. And there's lots of, like, we get the, there's a time travel. So lots of cartoons and TV shows that have referenced time travel and monkeys and all this other stuff. So again, you can kind of, I think probably if you really wanted to spend the time, you could map out where all these ideas come from, all the influences that lead to the idea of the 12 monkeys being like, there's a whole thesis. There's a whole film school thesis, and we don't have time for that, but we do have time for this. Yes, it's a semi-relevant movie quiz, a quiz where I try and stump Dave with stupid questions that are kind of about 1995's 12 Monkeys. We've got three questions for you today, Dave. And whoever wins, which hopefully will be you, gets to watch themselves get shot in the back as a child. So, good luck with the trauma of that.
Interesting. Are you ready, Dave? I could do with more layers. I'm a very dull individual. I don't have a lot of, like... I don't have a Batman origin story. If this is what gets me to Batman, which of course we can all agree is everyone's ultimate goal.
Yeah. Although, as we've discussed, it hasn't already, which means it never will or can't happen. So,
shit!
Damn it. Here we go. Anyway, let's get the first question. 12 Monkeys features a minor role for Mr. Plumber, who is just shows up in this movie for, like, I don't know, what is it, about 10 minutes? He's just hanging around, and I think that's a fun little cameo for Christopher Plummer. Now, he's one of 24 people to win the Triple Crown of acting. But what three awards does the Triple Crown include?
Well, so Christy, I know...
Christopher Plummer
has
won... Yeah.
From 30 Rock... that an EGOT is an Emmy, a Grammy, an Oscar, and a Tony. And is a Grammy... Grammy's for music? So therefore it's an Emmy, an Oscar, and a Tony?
Oh, is it right? Let's find out while I press the button. It is. Well,
Tracy
done.
Jordan and that stupid fucking necklace. Thank God. How good is 30 Rock, by the way? Why is no one talking about that? Because it happened 15 years ago, David. That's why.
I know. 30. Well done. Good pull.
As if I just pulled that out of my... I don't even know what a Tony is. It's not something on my radar.
I think it's like a... Is it more like a theatre award, is it?
Yeah, maybe.
Broadway, I think. Yeah, it is, yeah. So, living winners of the Triple Crown as... When this was written, include Rita Moreno, Jeremy Irons, Vanessa Redgrave, Maggie Smith, Al Pacino, Jeffrey Ross, Ellen Burstyn, Helen Mirren, Frances McDormand, Jessica Lange, and Viola Davis. So
that's a pretty good list, to be fair. That's pretty,
pretty good.
Good.
And there's only 24 people who've achieved that.
Wow.
This one, Dave, is from the movie itself, and it's going to be a test of your ability to remember things that happened to you. On what planet did L.J. Washington find himself on? Was it Pluto, Tribo, Mars, or Ogo?
I'm sorry, what?
Do you remember
Could you
this
repeat that whole thing?
Do you remember this character? In the Insane Asylum, what planet did L.J. Washington find himself on? Is it the planet Pluto? Is it Tribo, Mars, or Ogo?
I feel like it was a made-up planet.
I am making you rewatch this movie because I want to revel in all of the screenshots and trivia you're going to send me over the next 2 days. And then you're going to watch
Tribo
Brazil.
Or Obo, was it?
Pluto, Tribo, Mars, or Ogo?
I think it's the second one, Tribo, or whatever.
Tribo. The planet Tribo, obviously, Dave. Well, sorry, though. Ugh. It's, in fact, Ogo. What
Fuck's
a loser.
I knew it was one of those two. I knew it was made up.
What a loser. Go back and watch that movie now. Okay. Question.
That's question.
three? Is that right? Yeah, question three. 12 Monkeys is Terry Gilliam's highest grossing movie with $168 million worldwide gross. But how much less did his absolute box office flop, The Adventures of Baron Munchausen, make? Was it 57% less? Was it 94% less? Or was it 87% less? Now, while you think about
well,
this.
I think 50-odd percent less would still mean that Baron Munchausen made, like, 70 million, right?
75 I mean, million, wouldn't you're pushing my ability to do maths on the
floor.
Well,
like 50 something percent is sort of like half, and half of 168 million is 82 million. So 75. So that's still quite a lot of money. And this movie cost just under 30 million to make. I can't think about it. They gave him loads of money to make Baron Munchausen. And therefore, it's probably 87%, like 10% of it. You're talking like 16, 17 million probably if it was 87%. So what was the 91? 90?
94.
I think it was 94%, which I think would mean it made like 11 or 12 million.
Is it correct? It is correct. Well done, Dave.
Well, now, how was my maths?
I don't think your maths is exactly right, but then maybe mine isn't either. So let's go to Baron Munchausen. I've lost the goddamn page. Where is it gone? Baron Munchausen on Wikipedia, and let's have a look at and see how much it says. So this is a proper good flop. This is a budget of 46.
Wow, that's so high.
And it made 8. So we are like the opposite almost of what happened with Time Bandits, Derek Gilliam's. Honestly, Dave, I almost want to just say this is the next movie we're doing if it's streaming, because it's so insane. It's so insane that I don't think your brain's quite ready for it. But it's brilliant. It's got hugely critically...
we're just going to transition into the weird fucking artsy wanky movie podcast, because I'm there for it.
Yeah, 100%. I think...
Hello. Welcome to this week's episode of the Artsy Wanky Movie Podcast.
I think
I'm RC and here's wanky.
I'll take it. I think our hordes of listeners, and thank you for listening, if you're listening, can only... the metrics is only telling us to do more obscure movies. That's what happens.
I think the metrics are telling us, Sam, that we need to revisit Muppets Treasure Island, our highest listened episode.
I know,
by
for some...
about 700 million percent.
Talk about percentage increases. Holy Jesus. You guys love some Muppets, or at least the Spotify algorithm does. So, Dave, I think that means you've got 2 out of 3 available points, which means, sorry, that's not enough. You're still not going to witness yourself being shot in the back. And,
or not. Oh, that seems like a win.
No, you're also not going to go out with the 1990s Madeleine Stowe. So I think that's a real...
Damn.
It is indeed. So let's do a smattering of applause. And let's end the quiz.
Well, now. I'm better than you, Sam, because you didn't get any of my questions last week.
No, I didn't. It was a total failure. And I think the lesson is I made my questions far too easy. So I'll be coming at you with more very specific questions from scenes in the movie that you've only seen once. Like, what planet is that guy from?
What colour is the left-hand wall in the third shot in the mental asylum?
Please tell me the type of camera used on this specific shot in this scene from a movie that was made 40 years before.
God, you really want us to have no listeners, don't you? I mean, well, we're already there, but still.
We're practically there already. And that's, I think, you know, how much worse it get? And the answer is, statistically, it could get worse. It could get worse.
Have we done, I want to do this on air, have we done Who's Harry Crumb, the movie?
I've never seen it.
I'm not sure it's streaming. John Candy, I think we should do that next week, because specifically, I found the VHS copy that I've got. I know, and it's not.
You found.
So
the VHS.
I will watch if we do this movie. I will watch it on VHS.
That's not going to be true, because how have you got even? Have you got a VHS player? Is there
correct? Yeah, I have got a VHS player.
Would the tape even work?
I had to buy an HDMI to SCART lead to connect it to my TV.
That's fucking mental.
Because the technology is so obsolete that I cannot connect it straight to my modern TV.
That's mental.
Is it though?
Well, while you do that, Dave, I'm going to do what any other civilized person would do and just watch it on Amazon Prime. All right, Dave?
Maniac. Amazon Prime payers.